So that's the greedy leader that God resists. Peter then also mentions the belligerent leader. The belligerent leader. I would suggest that apart from some moral failure, this is one of the most common problems in leadership, and that's why I believe Peter mentions it here. He says in verse 3, "You are to shepherd the flock of God, exercising oversight, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock." Proving to be examples to the flock. And many times, leaders are just simply quarrelsome because they love control. And so their chief concern is to gain control for some personal interest, and their leadership becomes an intimidation. It's a technique for intimidating. And so what they do quite often is spend their time thinking of ways to motivate people by controlling them. Now, there are some characteristics that come to mind. It's interesting that Paul mentions them to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:24. The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, which is the opposite of being kind to all, able to teach them. In other words, skilled in bringing truth to people, but patient when wronged. To be a skilled person that brings truth to people, you've got to learn to be patient when wronged and not quarrelsome. The angry leader is a serious problem in ministry. Serious problem. 1 Timothy 3, verse 3, you should not be a pugnacious person, a fighter, a brawler, one who spoils for a fight, one who's easily offended, one who's quickly defensive and tries to intimidate people through control. And so here is another motivation that is sinful, and Peter addresses it as a danger to the leadership of the church. And the opposite of lording it over people is that you prove to be an example to the flock. If you want to counterattack the tendency to be belligerent in leadership and impatient and controlling for some personal reason, think about the role you have. You are called to model everything you expect from your people. You're called to model it first. Now, let's admit some things, men. All of us preach and teach or shepherd beyond where we are. This entire week's worth of seminars is on spiritual leadership, and I'm teaching you things that are way beyond where I consistently live. So, if I were to be leading you with impatience or intimidation or trying to coerce you to be a leader in our ministry according to my personal whims, if I were doing that, I have failed to think about my primary role as a leader. It isn't to instruct or dictate or command or take personal power and authority over people. That isn't my role. I have no personal authority over anyone. God has authority over his flock. Jesus Christ himself, as verse 4 of this text says, is the chief shepherd. So my flock is under his authority, not mine. So I am failing, if I'm belligerent, to think about my primary role. And it isn't to instruct. My primary role is to be an example to the flock so that what I say has credibility and weight. When you're raising children, you know, we're warned in the scripture not to exasperate children. And fathers particularly, leaders in the home particularly are warned not to exasperate children. Well, how do you exasperate someone under your care, someone who's dependent upon your care and your leadership? Well, I can think of two primary ways. One, gross spiritual neglect. You can just neglect your spiritual responsibility and you will exasperate and endanger the people under your care. But the worst kind of exasperation comes from hypocrisy, gross hypocrisy. to be instructing people in the standard of God's Word, which puts them under the weight of it, and then for you yourself to not be an example, but to try to drive them into it? That's exasperating. Very, very challenging to deal with a hypocritical leader. And for parents, when I was raising my kids, that was the first thing that my kids mentioned as they got older in the teen years. If I was manifesting some weakness in my leadership, they pointed out very quickly, because you're putting them under the weight of obligation, and yet at the same time not striving to be an example in that. So that's why Peter puts that over and against the belligerent leader. He says, here's how you correct that. Think about your primary responsibility. It is to be a model. That's your primary responsibility. To model character. In your leadership team dynamics, you can't be a man who reacts to mistreatment in a sinful way. Because you're the leader. You're the leader in the room. You're one to whom they look for an example. People know their own limitations to a large degree. And the guys on your leadership team and in the leadership of your church, they know their limitations. And so when they are at their worst in a leadership dynamic or a conflict, and when they come out with a sin or they say something they'd love to retract, but the offense has already occurred, if you react sinfully to that, you now have double trouble. Because you're the leader. You cannot violate your responsibility to be a model. The one who is weak in the room needs you to be strong. Spiritual leadership is a step ahead. Spiritual leadership is striving in a way that you can remain a step ahead. I mean, if what you say isn't profound to those who haven't yet learned those things, then what is the point? If you can't be an example of how to live under the pressure of ministry, you cannot lead others, and that's what Peter's point is here. If you're motivated by driving people through intimidation because you love the control and the comfort that comes from that because it protects your reputation, and you've not thought at all about your primary responsibility to be an example, you're violating the principle of spiritual leadership, and God resists that. He resists it. Now, what do you look for? Well, we've listed some things here. What do you look for? First of all, intolerance of others. Intolerance of others. In the belligerent leader, there is a tendency to be intolerant with other people's weaknesses. Not just impatience, but intolerance. We must learn as Christians to bear one another's weaknesses, and the leader must model that first. If you're intolerant, it's simply because you're protecting some self-interest. God resists attitudes like that. An intolerant leader is one who is thinking himself more important than others, and primarily to protect his reputation, as we'll see in a minute. And so what does he do? You have a weakness, you're going to be a bad reflection on me. So I'm intolerant of that. You have some limitation, I gave you a task, and you didn't accomplish it the way that you should have. That reflects poorly on me. And since my reputation is at stake, and that's most important to me, I am intolerant of you. Peter says, no, you're not supposed to lord leadership over people with intolerance for their weaknesses. Another thing to look for is arrogance and joylessness. Arrogance and joylessness. Why do I say joylessness? Well, a belligerent leader is trying to control his circumstances. And as we all know, God brings, in his providence, various difficulties at unexpected times in all of our lives as Christians. Trials. And a belligerent leader cannot have that happen because it's inconvenient. It doesn't allow them to control their circumstances for their own idolatry of comfort or their own idolatry of reputation. So when a trial comes, they lose their joy and they become harsh with people out of the simple irritation of it. James 1, 2 to 4 says we are to consider all joy when trials come. A belligerent leader can't do that. Circumstances out of his control are just too unacceptable to him. So he doesn't have a right perspective of trials. And so when weaknesses of other people create a trial in ministry, when idiosyncrasies of other people create a trial in ministry, when the shortcomings of others are creating a tension or a difficulty in ministry, instead of the leader thinking, oh, God's using that to grow us. He's using that to challenge me. He's using that to get me to crucify my flesh. He's using that in our lives to bring him glory. Instead of that being his perspective, he just can't accept circumstances that he cannot control. So he becomes unloving and intolerant of people. And in his arrogance, he basically becomes angry. One preacher captured the heart behind this anger with this assertion. Anger is the opposite of love because anger says, I matter so much. If you do something that I don't like, I'm going to let you have it. End quote. Because I matter so much. Everything I'm interested in matters so much. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20 is a good counter to this. Paul says, we're not our own. We're bought with a price. Glorify God with your life, your body, your appetites, everything. You're bought with a price. You're not your own. You don't come to ministry with some autonomy. And so we are called to be those who think about our example. And that means we've got to think, well, when the Lord puts a trial in my ministry, when my other fellow leaders have weaknesses, I need to be a ministry to them, alongside them, and realize that this is for my good too. This is for my good as well. Jim Shaddix, in talking about this issue, said, preacher, if your preaching is constantly calling people's attention to the crucified life, then those of us who listen to you will not have time to sing your praises. I like that. If your preaching is driving people because you're frustrated, if your teaching and discipling is driving people because you just have to control your circumstances, then you're going to drift into the love of praise as well as the love of power. But if you're constantly calling people to the crucified life and you're trying to model that, you won't be worried about whether your reputation is intact or whether people think well of you. You'll be more concerned with your own heart and whether or not you're responding rightly to God. So you look for intolerance of others. You look for arrogance and joylessness. And of course, that couples with self-righteousness and judgmentalism. The belligerent leader tends to be out of control in the area of self-righteousness. They think better of themselves. They like people to think better of themselves, and they too have a higher opinion of themselves than they ought. Look for a moment, just to give us a text to remind us of this, the importance of this. Matthew chapter 7. Again, just another text that's not unknown to you, but when Jesus speaks about self-righteousness, he gives us a principle here that helps us stay away from being the kind of leader that lords things over people. In Matthew 7, you remember that Jesus is talking about hypocrisy, and he says at the beginning, don't judge lest you be judged. He's not talking about don't ever discriminate or any of those kinds of things. We know that. The world often uses this verse to get you to be silent about moral issues. But in a Christian worldview and understanding this from God's perspective, we know that Jesus is saying, don't you self-righteously judge because you are no judge. That's what he's saying. How do we know that? Verses 2 and 3. And here is the frightening part of this principle. Jesus says, if you are a self-righteous person who's going around thinking more highly of yourself than you ought to think and condescending to other people in that self-righteousness, here's what's going to happen. Here's God's response. Verse 2. In the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. So here it is. Your response to people dictates God's level of compassion for you when you have weaknesses. This is a great principle for leadership. This will temper you in terms of whether or not you like to control people as a shepherd in your spiritual leadership. He says that in the way that you bring consequences into someone else's life for being less than you think they ought to be, the way that you bring those consequences, in other words, you lack compassion, you lack mercy, you don't give them any patience, you don't offer them any grace. In that same way, God is going to remove from His interaction with you any of that compassion, any of that mercy, any of that grace when He brings chastening into your life. That is massive. That is very helpful to me as a spiritual leader. That's what Peter meant when he said, prove to be an example to the flock, don't lord it over them. He's saying, look, you're no judge. And and if you enact consequences in either attitude or behavior, condescending to people that you think aren't measuring up to you, those same acts and attitudes are going to be the way God responds to you. You lack mercy and patience? God's not going to treat you with mercy and patience when you have weaknesses. Doesn't mean as a Christian you're not going to enjoy the grace of Christ or mercy with your failure. But a self-righteous, prideful leadership is going to receive such a chastening that isn't mitigated by the grace and mercy of God the way it could be. Because He's responding to you the way you're responding to other people. And secondly, the measure, the standard of measure, it'll be measured to you. The same standard you hold up other people to is what God's going to expect of you. Man, that principle alone ought to temper our leadership, because think about it. Wow, if I expect people to live at this level, I can never have anything less than that expectation for myself. Ever. Because if I do that, God is going to chasten me with that same standard. You say, well, His standard's always higher. Yes, but His standard involves the grace of Christ, doesn't it? God's standard is absolute perfection, but I'm covered by the grace of Christ. So if I'm just humble and walk in that, I enjoy the fruit of that grace in the patience of God. But what is saying, being said here is if you're self-righteous, God is going to come at you with a lack of compassion that you show other people, the lack of patience you show other people. God's chastening is going to reflect that. Whatever standard that you're holding over your flock or the people under your care, get ready and buckle your seatbelt, because God is going to hold you to that same hard line in His chastening of you. That's why he goes on to say, why do you look at the speck that's in your brother's eye, but you don't notice the log that's in your own? What is the log here? I mean, I've had people say to me, well, so what that's saying is that I have to correct all of my sin problems before I help somebody else with their sin. It's not the issue. The log here is self-righteousness. The log here isn't any particular weakness that you might have, and you have to get rid of that before you can help somebody else with theirs. That's not the point. The point is, get the log of self-righteous condescension out of your own eye, because that's bigger than anybody else's weakness that's irritating you. That's what he's saying. The ridiculous image of self-righteous hypocrisy in leadership is this. Other people have weaknesses. You're belligerent about them. You try to control them. You lord authority over them. That's personal authority. You do that for your own reputation. And the reality is you're trying to correct specks in their eye compared to the self-righteous log that is blinding you. Friends, belligerent leadership comes from this root of self-righteousness. I simply think I'm better than others and better than I really am. Peter says there's no place for that. There's no place for that. It's not some minor drawback when you get angry with people. It's not a minor thing If you have an anger problem at other people's weaknesses, it's not a small thing. It's not some minor infraction that other people just have to endure. Proverbs 19:19 says, a man of great wrath will pay the penalty. And if you deliver him from it, you're only going to have to do it again. The implication is, anger problems are a result of deep-rooted self-righteousness. They're not small things. I've seen angry leaders in the home, in their elder team and leadership team, in their Bible studies, in their pastoral ministry. And most often, it is excused or minimized. Lurking behind angry tantrums are idolatries, idols of reputation, idols of personal rights, idols of revenge. I deserve to be treated as I please, and my reputation matters most. My expectations will be met, or else. Martha Peace, in talking about this self-orientation, said this: one way we weave God into our self-focus is by having a self-focused view of the universe. Being overly taken with our own importance, we try to obligate God to grant our wishes and make us feel special. End quote. Man, that gets at the heart of the issue. When an angry leader shows up, what you want to say to him is that when science discovers the center of the universe, he's going to be really disappointed. And the fact is, you're not the center of the universe. And when you lead people out of that, it's because you have an idolatry that has to be dealt with. It's not some small, minor thing. One person said, you know, I have a temper, but it's all over in a minute. And the response was, yes, but so is the atom bomb. But the destruction is there. If you blow up in meetings, if you can't control your anger, you're trying to hold people under some personal obligation to you. And the result, or the motivation, is a desire to lord authority over people for your own personal gain or means. Scottish theologian Thomas Chalmers, great pastor in church history, said, we only cease to be the slave of one appetite because another taste has brought it into subordination. The young person may cease to idolize sensual pleasure, but it's only because the idol of material gain has gotten the ascendancy. There's not one personal transformation in which the heart is left without an object of beauty and joy. Its desire for one particular object may be conquered, but its desire to have some object is unconquerable. The only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. That's a great statement. And what it implies for us is that if you have controlling desires to lord leadership over people, the only way to expel that out of your heart is the Spirit-controlled desire to be an example of Christ to the flock. That's what Peter is saying. Now you may be thinking, well, Pastor, I don't see intolerance of others in my behavior. I don't see arrogance and joylessness in my behavior. I don't necessarily see this kind of harsh, self-righteous judgmentalism. Well, what about sinful fear and insecurity? What about sinful fear and insecurity, which is rooted in conceit? Romans 12:3 says, We ought not to think more highly of ourselves than is reasonable, but we ought to think so as to have sound judgment. We ought to think of ourselves as sinners saved by grace. And if you become enamored with your own gifts, or you use your giftedness as a way to feel significant or important about yourself, you're going to run into a problem with conceit and insecurity. We use the word insecurity in secular society. I really like the word, but it doesn't go far enough. The biblical idea is sinful fear of man. That's really what's happening in a person who is sinfully insecure and wants to feel significant and uses their ministry as a way to feel significant. Now, let's see how this unfolds a little bit in the life of this person in 3 John named Diotrephes. This man is an example of sinful fear and insecurity, which is rooted in conceit. He was probably the senior pastor of a church, and yet he was under the tutelage and mentoring of John, who was very, very important to a set of pastors and in the churches, of which Diotrephes was one. And yet he came to the place in his ministry where he began to resist the authority of leaders that were over him, or apostolic authority. He began to resist it, and there are some things said about him in 3 John that help us understand what happens when a man is sinfully fearful and insecure and looking for significance. And by the way, I would just say, men, that you can say, well, I don't have an acute problem in the other things that we've talked about, what to look for. But I'm going to tell you right now, this one I see all the time. And this one is subtle. Using leadership for significance, using it to feel significant, using your sermon preaching and your Bible study and those things to puff yourself up, to make yourself feel significant, to win the honor of other people, the lure of the praise of people, this is subtle. Sometimes in a person where it's really open and blatant, it's easy to discover and people don't pay them much attention. But in most cases I've experienced, pastors can become quite subtle in the desire for significance in ministry. I mean, you meet them all the time. You get involved in some project in leadership, and they have to be the one that puts themselves out front. They quickly become uncomfortable around someone else who's gifted. They, you know, there's all kinds of manifestations of someone who is conceited about themselves, looking for significance, and they become fearfully and sinfully insecure in their leadership. This is Diotrephes. This is who he was. And he would satisfy himself with the praises of men. Notice what it says of him in 3 John. In verse 9, John says, I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, doesn't accept what we say. He loves to be first. It's the word for he loves to have the front preeminence. He wants to be known as the man in ministry and among his leadership team. He's got to be the guy whom everyone is listening to. He wants to be the guy who's well thought of as the exalted one in his abilities. He wants to be the guy whom everyone thinks has the greater gifts. He would have fit well in Corinth. And he's unsubmissive. Notice verse 9, he doesn't accept what we say. There's a characteristic of this conceit and that leads to insecurity. You resist any authority that God has placed you under. You don't like it. Because it's scrutiny you don't want. It's someone challenging your desires in a way that you would have to conform to. So you'd have to cultivate humility. And this guy is not humble. He's conceited. So it's obvious that if you're conceited, sinfully fearful and insecure, you're not going to come to authority that's placed over you with a willing heart. And that was him. He didn't accept what the apostle himself says. And so verse 10, John says, for this reason, if I come, I'm going to call attention to his deeds, which he does. What are his deeds? Well, he's unjustly accusing us. That's what they resort to. A fearfully insecure person undermines the character of other leaders. You know, spinning a little story, undermining character, slandering a reputation, whispering little words over here, throwing little grenades, verbal grenades across the bow of this leader to sort of get him to think ill of this person over here. He's planting landmines to undermine the interests and giftedness and usefulness of other people. And that's what Diotrephes was doing. He's unjustly accusing the apostle in the midst of his congregation. Now, John's not there. Well, that's convenient. The apostle's not there to defend himself. The congregation doesn't know. The sheep are vulnerable. Whenever I see a leader who is manifesting tendencies toward insecurity and wanting to satisfy idols of significance, I know what's coming. I know that at some point he's going to find lightning rods in the church or sheep with their own complaints, and he'll become the lightning rod of their complaints. And that will turn into whispering about other men in ministry and other leaders around whom this person is uncomfortable. And they don't even have to have had any altercation with another leader. They're just sinfully insecure about their own significance. And so any other leader makes them uncomfortable. So what do they have to do? They have to unjustly undermine. They have to misrepresent the truth. They have to misrepresent decisions the elders make. They have to misrepresent the leadership's integrity in front of certain sheep. They have to find and seek out certain sheep that are vulnerable to their perspective. And when they have gained the attention of that sheep or those sheep that make them feel significant, then they use those sheep to undermine the leaders in the minds of the other sheep. You ever had that happen in a church? It's quite common in an insecure leader. It was common in Diotrephes. And he unjustly accused them with wicked words. So, paneros, false words. He was not satisfied with just misrepresenting the truth. He actually made up things. So he's dishonest. He made up slander or negatives about the apostle to gain the significance and praise for his own leadership. And that wasn't enough. Verse 10, and not satisfied with this, he himself doesn't receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. What do you mean, the brethren? Well, Gaius is the subject, really, of 3 John, and Gaius was a person whom the church trusted. The apostles trusted that when they sent a missionary out to a church to do ministry or out to the mission field, Gaius was one of those hosts that if you sent missionaries to his house, man, he lived the gospel in front of them. He spoke the words of the gospel and truth to them. He was an encouragement to the missionaries. He supplied them with needs. He exercised hospitality. He encouraged them on their way. And when they left, they reported back to John what a tremendous man of integrity and godliness Gaius was and how he'd helped them on their way. Listen, traveling as a missionary was tough in those days. Resources were hard to come by. There was danger around every corner, not only from robbers, but people that were against the church and against the gospel. And so you had slanderers and talebearers and people who would steal your supplies and then criminal behavior. And so if you were a traveling missionary, finding a guy like Gaius was like an oasis because he spoke the truth, the same truth they'd heard from the apostle. He lived the truth in front of the missionaries. He supplied them with encouragement. He risked his own reputation to house them, and he sent them on their way in a manner pleasing to God, says verse 6. And so John is writing the letter to say, hey, I want you to support a guy like Gaius. You need to support this guy. He sent those missionaries out. He's a fellow worker with the truth. But Diotrephes, a senior pastor over here at this congregation, we sent missionaries to him. And when he found out they were sent by the Apostle John, he said, nope. We're not accepting you. And then the people in his congregation, out of compassion, wanted to receive the missionaries. And what does John say that Diotrephes did? He forbid even the people in his church who desired to receive the missionaries. And he even did church discipline on them if they did it. This guy is out of control. He is completely filled up with sinful fear and insecurity about his own significance. So when you think about this particular motivation of lording it over people, one of the things I look for is insecurity in a leader. I want to know what they think about their own significance. Do they have habits of life that search for their own significance? This guy loved power and control because he loved to be preeminent in the minds of others. And he got so controlling with it that he became belligerent in his leadership. 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, a young couple, their parents started attending our church. I didn't know the young couple, but I met their parents who started attending our church. And they told me that they had a son and a daughter-in-law that were attending a church, and they were concerned about that church. And so I told them I'd be glad to talk to this couple. And so this couple called me in secrecy, they said. And I said, "What's the problem?" They said, "We will be in massive trouble if our pastor and our church know that we're on the phone with you." I said, "What do you mean? I don't understand." And they began to describe for me a situation like this, where a pastor claims to be a shepherd of his flock, dropping all kinds of names about leaders that he reads that would be familiar to us and conferences that he attends, you know, trying to portray himself as in the mainstream and one of us, where privately in his ministry, he is a Diotrephes, where he undermines other leaders that are gifted. He undermines other ministries. And when people come to his church, he puts them under such a constraint, such a personal authority. And then when they decide or hear that maybe that's not how the Christian life ought to be lived, and they're growing out of that vulnerability, he then comes harshly against them and kicks them out of the church if they don't respond to him. In fact, it got so bad that he called me on the phone when he found out they came down to our church at their parents' request. And they showed up on a Sunday, and they were sheepish and nervous and looking over their shoulder like the Gestapo was on their heels. And so I just said to them, "Well, if you'd like, I'll just call your pastor." So they gave me his number. So I called and left him a message. So he called me back. And he sounded like any friendly shepherd of the sheep that you would talk to initially on the phone. And then he said to me, he said, "Look, I just want you to know that they're coming to your church because they are... you know, two young people that they weren't married yet at the time. They were engaged. They're two young people that just want to have a relationship of immorality behind the scenes, and they don't want any accountability. So, you know, we're just trying to shepherd them in that. And that's why they're trying to escape our accountability as a leadership team, because they just want to live immorally. And so I just know that when you send them back here, we'll just help them. So why don't you just send them back here?" And I said, "Well, are they presently in sin as a relationship?" He said, "Well, I just know that's their heart. That's their motive. That's where they're going." I said, "So you've never caught them in any, you know, fornication, immorality?" "No, but, you know, we know that that's where their heart is. They're young. They're lustful. That's what's going to happen. So just send them back to us." And so I'm thinking, you know, there is a major issue here. So I said, "Well, if it indeed is true that that's in their heart, then the best thing is for them to be in the church so that they can have that exposed. And since they now want to come to our flock, I'm assuring you that we'll take care of them. And if that sin arises, we'll shepherd them through that." Well, the next voice I heard on the phone was completely the opposite. And it was tense and angry and controlling and citing all kinds of biblical verses. And so I just went to 1 Peter 5 and warned him that leadership is to prove to be an example to the flock. And if he wanted this young couple to see him as a shepherd that's trustworthy, then the best way he could respond to this situation is to thank the Lord for the privilege he's had to shepherd them, thank the Lord that they're going to be coming to a good church, and tell him he's praying for them and that he loves them. That's what he needs to do to prove to be an example to them. And that was the end of that. This was a Diotrephes situation. Shortly after that, Well, that next Sunday, he stood up and read a letter castigating them and refusing for any of the people in his church to talk to them, calling them unbelievers, pagans and apostates, right there publicly in his church. We only found that out because, as in all of those kinds of churches, there are leaks, you know. People inside the church find a way to get information out to their the people that have been bludgeoned and sent out. And sure enough, there was another young couple in their church that were afraid to leave, but they were leaking out information about what was said. And I grieved over that. That couple, by the way, were married in our church shortly after that. They flourish in our ministry. They cannot be more thankful at the rescuing operation that God did in their life through the admonitions of their loving parents. And that's a situation where a man has become so conceited and interested in his own significance that he's willing to dominate people at his own peril and at the peril of the ministry. Guys, if you have those tendencies in your heart, you have a tendency to become a belligerent leader. You have the potential of controlling ministry rather than thinking about your obligation to be an example to the flock. And that's a problem. So what do I look for? I mean, if I want to evaluate my heart on this, let's get right down to the core of it. What do I look for? First of all, if you view others as a threat to your success, you have this potential. If you initially view others as a threat to your success, you say, how do I know whether I'm doing that? Are you comfortable around equally or more gifted people than you who are your peers? Are you comfortable around them? In other words, in ministry, when someone comes along and they can do what you do and they actually do it as well, if not better, are you comfortable with that? Are you thankful for that? Do you rejoice in your heart over that? If you don't, you're insecure. You like significance. You use your gifts to feed your significance. When somebody teaches better than you, preaches better than you, when someone comes along and they just have an ability with people that you struggle to have, are you thankful for the advancement of the kingdom that comes through their gifts? And would you be willing to highlight their gifts? If you're afraid of that, you've got some insecurity there. These leaders burn huge amounts of energy keeping others from succeeding. Do you do that? How about whether or not you're unteachable when you're contradicted? If somebody on your leadership team or in your church disagrees with you and contradicts you, if you're hungry for power over others, you're going to be compelled to shut that critique down quickly. Doesn't matter whether it's true or false to you, because unteachable leaders, they ground their influence in intimidation. So ask yourself, when a critique comes or you're contradicted, are you teachable? Is that your initial response? Okay, I can hear this. I need to. It may not be true in the end. I may find out that it's a perspective that's all wet, but can I be open initially to a critique? Guys, I know how that is. That's a hard one. Because we know our own hearts. Somebody comes along and says, you know, it was a good Bible lesson, but there's some things that I think you could do to improve. Oh, man. What happens to you right then? Be honest with yourself. Really? Man, I thought it was good. I don't think there's anything I'd change about that. And even if there were, I don't want it coming from you. How about the tendency to let others bear the blame for failed decisions? If something you decide as a leadership team doesn't quite work out the way you'd planned or represents, you know, an unwise path, do you admit the wrong, take responsibility, and happily take responsibility for the overall outcome? Are you willing to bear that burden? Or are you quick to say, you know, yeah, that was so-and-so. I gave them that job. They really blew it. distancing yourself from the, you know, the poor fool that was asked to carry out the task. Insecure leaders regularly blame shift. They don't like the risk. And so if they do at some point make a decision collectively and it fails, the first thing they do is try to place the quick and dirty blame on whomever the guy was that let that thing fail. They don't shepherd someone who needs to do a better job. They actually blame them. And that also leads then to sort of a controlling view of resources. A person who's insecure withholds important resources from other people because I can't risk it. And if I give you resources, you might do better than me. I can't risk that. If I give you resources and tell you to do a job and you fail, I can't risk that because it reflects on my reputation. A sinfully fearful and insecure leader obsesses over the transfer of communication and the transfer of vital resources. They obsess over it. What do you know? How much do you know? Where did you get that information? Who gave you that information? Why did they give you that information? Who's talking behind my back? They just get really suspicious and controlling about resources and information in ministry. When I see that, I know what the problem is right off the bat. They are afraid to risk any personal investment in the life of the church because it's too risky for their reputation. They're protecting their own significance. And so what does that lead to? They're unwilling to delegate responsibility. They're fearful that they may suffer in their reputation. So they can become quickly jealous that someone might take those resources and do a better job than them. I knew a man one time who withheld an area of ministry from another man who was far more qualified to do that ministry by multiple years and experience and was already well respected in other areas of ministry for that experience. And he was held away from the most ideal place for him to use his gifts for the massive advancement of that area of ministry because of an insecure leader who knew he could do the job better but wanted to be known as the guy that could do that. And it came to a head in a meeting when I said to this person, "Why don't you let that person do that ministry?" And that person looked at me dead in the eye and said, "Because that's the ministry I do." Wow, okay. That is a person who is struggling with personal significance. So men, God resists leaders like that. He resists leaders like that. And so you want to look for those tendencies. Are you the kind of leader that is intolerant of others and cannot accept someone's life weaknesses because it's a threat to your reputation or the convenience of your own control of the ministry? Are you joyless because people represent trials in the ministry or put you at risk and you just can't handle that because you don't see trials as that which grow you? You see them as just unfortunate inconveniences caused by the shortcomings of others. If that's the case, you're violating what Peter says. You're lording it over the flock. If you see self-righteousness in you where somebody has a weakness and you just can't forgive, you just can't let the offense go, you just can't be patient, then know this, God is going to hold you that at same standard. He's going to measure out His chastening grace according to the kind and measure of grace that you offer to other people whom you perceive to be weak. And you have a big log of self-righteousness in your eye at that point. And so you have to remove that before you can help somebody else. So think about the sad scenario that is. If you have self-righteousness and judgmentalism because you are a belligerent leader lording it over the flock, the sad reality is you're not leading anyone. because they have specks in their eye, weaknesses in their life, and you can't help them with those, because Jesus says, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you can see clearly to help someone with their speck. Here you are, a shepherd, saying that you want to help people, and the sheep don't even know that you have no resources to help them, because you can't see clearly to help them. You're bound up with your own view of yourself. Or are you sinfully fearful and insecure about your own significance? That you would start undermining other leaders. That you would secretly whisper in order to keep somebody a little lower because you don't like their giftedness. You're not comfortable with the fact that people might look to them. The Pharisees had this problem. And so when Jesus came on the scene, they actually even admitted it. Look, the whole world has gone after him. What are we going to do about it? I don't care what his message is. I don't care if he's from God. I don't care what his claims are. I don't care what the proof is. All I know is he's become significant, and that's taking away from mine, and I want to ruin that. If you're on a leadership team and you have a tendency to resent someone else on that leadership team, you got a problem in this area. And I would encourage you strongly to find a mentor who has tackled this issue in their heart and say, look, I'm going to get in your back pocket on this sanctification issue. I have got to learn how to deal with this issue. Get in their back pocket. Learn from them. Early in my ministry, I don't know why. I think I was just so concerned that I might foul the thing up. That I, when I saw someone who had a handle on character flaws, I just went right up to them and said, you owe me. You got to disciple me. Because that's an area I need to learn and I want to grow in that. You got to help me with that. And, you know, I haven't always been that aggressive in working on my weaknesses because I have to deal with pride as well. But in some seasons of ministry, that's necessary. You gotta find some help. You have men in this very room, men in this very church, men in your own church that may not be leaders or elders. They're just godly men. You gotta go to them and say, you know, you've tackled this area in your heart. I can see it in your life. And I can tell that you have been down this road. I need your help or I'm going to hurt the sheep. Are you willing to do that? Because if you're not, God is resistant to your ministry. You want to have maximum blessing. You don't want to be in a pattern that God resists in terms of your ministry. Peter adds a final motivation here that's a good one, and it's the most frightening of all. It's not a bad motivation, it's a good one, but it is indeed the most compelling. 1 Peter 5, verse 4. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. You say, is the motivation the unfading crown of glory? I don't think so. That's motivation enough, but I think the bigger motivation is that first statement. When the chief shepherd appears. You know, out of all the statements Peter has made, you know, the commands, shepherd the flock of God, don't do it out of compulsion, according to the will of God, voluntarily, with eagerness, no money longing for money, don't lord it over your people, prove to be examples. Out of all those commands, this is the thing that strikes me the most. Jesus Christ, the chief shepherd, is coming. What will he find in me? I know he already knows my weaknesses. So I know he already knows where I need to shore things up, and I know he already is working on those things by his Spirit. But where will he find me stubborn in my pride? Where will he find me refusing to shepherd like he would? And know this, he is the chief shepherd in this one primary sense. He's never flawed in his shepherding of God's people. He knows exactly what people need, and he's never wrong in his ministry to his people. So I want to get myself out of the way and be an instrument for the chief shepherd to bless his people. And if I've got these tendencies, I don't want them to become stubborn patterns. When you read this text, you think, that's me. Yep, that's me. Oh, I've seen that. Yep, I've got that. I've got to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Got to grow there. The question is, are you aware of those things and doing nothing about them? Because if it becomes a pattern, you're hurting the flock purchased by the chief shepherd. And it is the flock of God, Paul told the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, which he purchased with his own blood. It's his flock. It's not mine. So, I don't care how you were raised. I don't care the church you grew up in, spiritual heritage you think you have, the pedigree that you are attached to. I don't care the theological training you have or think you have. I don't care about how many years of study or how many classes you've taught. None of that matters at all. None of that makes us significant. What matters is when the chief shepherd appears, is he going to find in me someone who wasn't stubborn about these things but was willing to work on them? That's the only question that matters. And so, Peter then admonishes the church, not just the elders. And you can imagine if you were a young man reading this in the congregations to which he was writing, verse 6 would have been profoundly impacting after what he has just said. Verse 5 rather. You younger men likewise, be subject to your elders. Be a submitter. This should be the pattern of your life as leaders. This should be the pattern of your life as young men. Be submitters. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud but gives grace to the humble. There it is. The younger men coming up in the church ought to learn from you. And so you ought to be the kind of leader that says, yeah, I can tend to be these things. I have been these things. These are wrong motivations. I need to learn to be better at the others. But let me tell you what, I'm concerned when the chief shepherd appears that I'm doing what God blesses and not what he opposes. And so I'm going to teach you younger men likewise to be subject, be a submitter to the authorities God has placed over you, just like the elder is submitting to Christ. You young men submit to the elders, and all of you do it by being completely clothed together in humility, knowing this, God opposes and resists any other kind of leader, any other kind of Christian. But he will bless with grace those who strive to get rid of these problems. And I like that. I like that. That helps me then understand the joy of properly motivated ministry. So we want to be leaders that God resists. We want to be those that are striving with the right heart to be faithful.